The brain, as you know, is like our CPU. It controls everything we do. Sleep is an important brain function. It's not just something we do. It's an important brain function. The analogy that I use is kind of like when you go to sleep, your car goes into the garage, all these mechanics come out, they clean it up, they gas it up, they change the oil, they get it ready. And when you wake up, you're good to go for the day. You know, when you're not getting enough sleep, your car is coming out of the garage with a half a tank of gas, and you end up crashing.
All right, welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. And the idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who are on the frontier, who are on the path of mastery, who have a command of the nuances of their craft, people who are changing the way we understand how an industry works. And we want to understand how they see the world, how they see themselves in it, the unique journey that has led them to that point of view. And we also want to dig deeper to understand the mental skills that they've used to build and refine their craft. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this conversation is with Pat Byrne, and the conversation is really about his building an entrepreneurial venture based on sleep technology. And the importance of getting quality sleep is a well-accepted principle, research-based. And on average, we know that we need somewhere between 7 and 8 hours sleep to to be our best version of ourselves, to be vibrant and to have the capacity and brain capacity to think clearly and quickly and all that good stuff. Now, what Pat's done is he's been one of those pioneers in the field that have been able to bridge well-accepted principles in science with emerging technologies. And there's so many gems and nuggets inside this conversation about sleep and where he comes from and how he's dedicated his life efforts and why he's become a game changer. He's definitely shifted the way professional sport franchises operate. And he's had an impact in the industry. That's a phenomenal statement. Before he came along with this technology, there was the talk of how important sleep is, and now there's actually a way to monitor it. So it is a game-changing experience in pro sports. So I'm so excited to get into this conversation, to introduce Pat, if you're not familiar with his work. And for those of you who are not familiar with his work, I just hope that this conversation really reveals his genius. So with that, let's jump right into this conversation with Pat. Pat, how you doing?
Hey, Mike, I'm great.
Yeah, very cool. So this is a conversation that I think about a lot. Not actually the conversation, the topic of conversation. I think about it so much, which is sleep and quality sleep and quantity sleep and getting that right as a recovery platform for a competitive advantage. And you and I met a number of years ago in Elite Sport, and I've been fascinated about what you've done in the space as a business person and then also as a scientist that's working to understand it at a rich level. So, Pat, can you first introduce like how you came interested in sleep, and then we're going to wind back from there. So just start with that conversation about sleep.
No, absolutely. This goes back a few years. Into the mid-1980s, I was what's called an appeal commissioner here in British Columbia, which is certainly in the U.S. It's the equivalent of an appeal court judge in the administrative law courts, mostly dealing with occupational health and safety issues. And I actually thought I knew what I was doing. I was the Canadian director on the board of what's called the IOHA, which is part of the World Health Organization and the International Labor Organization, dealing with sort of global health and safety issues. But one day I got a phone call from my brother-in-law, and it turns out my 22-year-old nephew fell asleep driving home from work one night and drove his car off a cliff and died.
Oh my goodness. How old was he?
22.
Oof.
He was not only my nephew, he was my godson. And a few years previous to that, I'd watched him play basketball in the provincial championship, and his challenge there was to guard Steve Nash. You know what? They were pretty much tied at halftime, but then Steve was obviously the best player on the floor, and he went on to win. You know, whatever. My nephew went on to study forestry, but worked really long hours. And for me, as a health and safety professional, I was shocked. Going, you mean people fall asleep driving home from work and die? Like, what is this? And I had called my colleagues that I've known for many years from all over the world, and actually nobody at that point was even talking about the issue. So that started my journey in terms of trying to figure out what sleep had to do with, at that point, dying on the job, and eventually going into how do we make athletes better athletes.
Okay, so it started with some pain.
Yes.
Okay. And then, so people have heard me say this often. I just wonder if you would agree or maybe this conversation is clouding the objectivity you could have in this statement. But would you agree or disagree with the thought that the reason people change is because of pain?
Part of it is pain. I think it would just snap my head around. Right? It's like throwing cold water on your face, whether you call that pain or something else.
Okay.
Right. It shakes you out of where you are in the world.
How did that shape you? Like what's the right way to think about this? Like what level of significant alteration in your life course did that event and the loss of your loved one shape the current state that you're in now, the current person you're in now?
Right. It was 100% change. It was like 180 degrees. I actually quit my job. as an appeal court judge.
What does it take to become an appeal court judge in Canada, right?
Right. I had spent 20 years in the system. I had worked in the asbestos litigation in the United States and Canada. I had, I spent literally 20 years and was appointed by high-level people to hear cases and went to law school, didn't graduate from law school, but I took some law school classes. So it was 20 years of work.
Oh, so you do not, to be an appeal judge, you do not need to have a law degree?
I was one of the few that didn't.
What are you guys doing up in Canada? Huh?
Yeah, you know, they actually want people to know something about the subject they're dealing with.
That's loaded. That is such a loaded answer. That's so good. Okay, we should not talk about systems right now, right? Governmental systems in particular.
Yeah, you don't want to go there yet. Yeah.
Okay, so then, how did you get into that field, like wanted to be in the law field? And now we're winding further back.
Yeah, I didn't actually, that wasn't ever interesting to me. I was a health and safety, much like a sort of an OSHA inspector in Canada. And one day the head of the legal department in our governmental organization called me up because I'd done a lot of work on asbestos. And he said, you know what, we want to sue the asbestos companies. We think that they're causing death and destruction amongst hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of workers in our province, and we're going to sue them. Can you help me with this? And I go, what can I do? And he goes, well, can you go to South Carolina? And I'm going, yeah, I can do that. So I ended up working with Ron Motley, who most people don't know, but if you Google him, he is probably considered the most important trial lawyer ever in the United States. He bankrupted virtually all the asbestos companies. He bankrupted the tobacco companies. He did the 911 litigation. Mm. And I got to spend 4 years with him. And also the president of Canadian Bar Association as well, another guy named J.J. Kemp. And I had to travel all over the U.S. and Canada and in Europe with the two of them and asked a whole lot of stupid questions about law. So when we got settlement mechanisms, so all the victims of these victims and their families got money from this, I decided I have to go back to my old job. And they said, well, that's probably not going to happen. And I thought, well, that was my career. What am I going to do? And then I got a phone call one day from a senior government official who said, can you come to lunch? And how would you like to be a senior appeal judge? And I'm going, okay. we're going to send you to law school. So, I mean, that's it came about. It was just working with some and that's how I've learned throughout my entire career, is learned from really, really smart people will ask a whole lot of stupid questions.
And then how do you get to smart answers if you're asking dumb questions?
I think they're dumb questions. They obviously didn't.
Yeah, I know. You're doing that little funny thing, right? I'm joking too, like in a dry way. Like you're asking questions, you're learning. That's your process to learn.
Right. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
And I guess neither of us are very funny because neither of those jokes worked.
But you're absolutely right. That's how I've learned everything in my career, from whether it's sleep or fatigue or sports, everything I've learned from just connecting with really smart people and asking them hard questions.
Okay. I want to ask you what I think I don't know if they're hard or not, so I don't want to put you on the spot with anything, but there are questions that I can't quite sort out. And that's like the technical part of the sleep conundrum, if you will, and the mechanisms and the mechanics to be a better sleeper as well. So let's hold that for a moment. So can you wind us back to what early life felt like?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I grew up in northern Canada, which is up near it's a little town called Fort Nelson, which is in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And it was the head of the U.S. Army headquarters for the building of the Alaska Highway. My father was a carpenter that lived up there. And the town was probably 1,500 people. And we had, in those days, no radio, no television, no magazines, no newspapers. Basically, what we got was from school. And the school I went to was the old U.S. Army barracks. Right. We had outdoor toilets, seriously. So you had to go up minus 40 and go to the bathroom.
Come on.
And so.
What did that teach you?
Resilience. I thought that was the world. I mean, we had a neighbor who was killed by a cougar, right? I remember waking up, opening our front door one day to go outside, and there was a moose standing there face to face, right? I mean, that for me was life. But what really, I think in terms of my learning experience was we had these books we used to read at school, and I saw these kids flying kites. And I thought, man, I'd love to have a kite. I'm going to build one of those. And so my father was a carpenter, so we had a lot of material around, excess material. So I took a bunch of 2x4s and nailed them together in the shape of a kite and tied a rope to it and dragged it around the yard. And shockingly, it didn't fly. what it taught me was that I can't invent anything and I can't build anything, but I can learn from this.
Pat, was that an insight you had at that moment, or is that looking back like that was the first time that you were?
Yeah. I think part of that was looking back, but part of it was initially was, and I was just talking, I was 7, 8 years old, was, oh my God, I can't build anything. Right? I mean, I was kind of entrenched in my mind at the time. It's like, oh, you don't know how to do this. Right? Okay. And that kind of carried through. And then when I was in high school, my parents moved down to the what's called Lower Mainland, which is the Vancouver area. I went to high school there. And it was the same thing. I mean, the education I had in Northern Canada wasn't that great. And when I was in my junior year in high school, which is we call grade 11 here, I was failing chemistry, like seriously failing chemistry. And the teacher came to me and he said, look, I will pass you in chemistry 11 if you promise not to take chemistry in grade 12. Oh, I'm going, God. Oh my God, thank you. I will do this. Okay. Unfortunately, between—
Did you not understand that, it, or did you not apply yourself, or did you—
I couldn't understand the concepts. Like, it just was foreign to me. It was like trying to learn Mandarin. I didn't understand anything. Mm. And unfortunately, during that summer, I had met a girl that I'd fallen in love with, my high school girlfriend. And she was really bright in science, and she was taking chemistry 12 the senior year. So I thought, well, I just want to be with her. So I took it anyways.
Oh, there you go. So are you a little bit of a rule breaker?
Bender, yes. Bender, okay. Bender, yeah. Breaker. Sometimes I pretended I didn't hear what he had to say. And I didn't actually do that well. I passed chemistry 12 mostly because I was looking over my girlfriend's shoulder and and did it. But that always bothered me, that there was something that other people were getting that I couldn't get.
How did you internalize that? Like, what did you do, or how did you explain that information?
For me, it was just a challenge. Like, I felt like there was something missing in me, and I didn't know if it was missing in me or missing in my teachers or missing in how it was taught, but it frustrated me. And so—
So if you were to have 100 conversations with yourself in the span of 2 weeks, let's just say, about this thing that we're talking about, would you make it about yourself? Like, damn, what is wrong with me? Or would you make it about them? And then I got part two question, which is, is it something that's temporary, or was it more permanent, the way that you would explain it?
Right. For me, it was about me, not them.
Okay. Right? So you would internalize it.
Right. Because I thought, you know what, in all other areas, whether it was playing sports at the time or the other courses I took, I thought I was even with everybody else in the class, but I just couldn't get any of this. So I thought there was something wrong with me.
And then so your self-esteem will take a hit from that, but you can get better. You give yourself a better chance of getting better when you're like, well, you know, I need to do something about this.
Yeah. So you know what I did? When I went to university, I majored in chemistry.
No kidding.
I just said, okay, I'm going to tackle this head on. And so I went to Western Washington University in Washington State, and ended up with a bachelor's degree in chemistry and a master's degree in biochemistry.
So what, when you say that out loud, what happens for you?
For me it was like, okay, I sort of slayed the dragon.
And when you say that now, what happens, yeah, when you say it like now, even in this conversation?
I mean, it's emotional for me.
Yeah.
Right? It's a victory. It's like winning something, right? It's like, oh my God, this was something that I couldn't do and I wouldn't give up.
Okay. So Pat, you're a disruptor in the field of sleep and technology. And I don't know if you're going to say that about yourself, but I'll put that out there. And then, so let's stay on this for just a moment. Is it how... did you do that? How did you go from, oh my God, this professor doesn't believe in me, I'm struggling, I can't do it, it's me that's broken, it's not them predominantly, and then to actually get a university degree in it? How?
I'm not even sure I know the answer to that. For me, it was a void. It was a challenge. Something that was missing in my life, the something I needed to answer.
What did that feel like? Was it like in your body? Was it in your mind? Like, how did that emptiness happen?
I think it was in both. I felt completely unfulfilled. I felt like this was, there was something in my mind that said, look, my confidence in a lot of other areas was you can do anything if you put your mind to it. But I wasn't able to accomplish that in chemistry or biochemistry. And I thought, well, I need to find a way to make that happen. And so I just pushed myself. In fact, after my third year in university, I'd finished all my fourth year classes in chemistry. I had teachers that were able to explain concepts to me, and all of a sudden the light bulb went on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So nobody ever had to ask me to read a book once I got switched on. It was like, it was a consumption. And you know what? I get that, like, this is going to sound hubris or arrogant. I don't mean it to be by any means, but like in that space, I feel like I see something. Like, I see something inside of the way that I see other people's minds. And it's like, I love that. Like, I don't know where it comes from, but something was switched on early on. I think you have that same thing on taking insights from other people, practices from other people, science that other people have built, and turn it into a disruptive business.
And
is that right?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I kind of consider myself an innovator. Like, I can't create or invent anything. You know, my kite's a good example. But what I see is the way to take technology that's used in one space and innovate it and use it in another space. And that's what I did with sleep.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming... full stop. They are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out. Okay. All right. So then you're switched on about sleep. You had somebody that you lost a loved one. And you said, what is going on here? You took a deep dive, you went into research, and what did you researching? I'm imagining you researched the sleep condition for humans, and that probably took you to military studies. Is that where you went?
For the most part, yeah. And I think, you know, and it's important to keep in context what's happened with sleep research, which is incredibly new.
That's right.
Everything we know about sleep was done in my lifetime. I was born in 1953, and when I was born, there was virtually one scientist in the world doing sleep research, Nathaniel Kleitman at University of Chicago. And it was generally considered the dregs of sleep, dregs of research. Mm. And in fact, Watson and Crick had published their papers on, on DNA 6 months before any major research was ever published on sleep.
No kidding. Okay. All right. So you entered. When did you enter the scene?
I entered the scene in probably 10, 11 years ago from now.
Okay.
So I came into it. There was nothing going on. They didn't have any. There was no way to measure sleep. And so my background in occupational health and safety is in a field called occupational hygiene, which has to do with chemical and biological safety, for workers. And the premise for all of them is to be able to measure risk and to fix it. And so I used that model looking at sleep from a health and safety perspective, saying, how do we measure sleep? How do we measure fatigue? How do we measure accident risk? And then how do we fix it? And so what I discovered was virtually nothing was in the marketplace, zero. But I found pieces of it. Okay. So what I found was that in sleep research, they had what's called medical grade actigraphs, which we now call sleep watches, right? These big bulky things. And you have to take the raw data, which is zeros and ones essentially, and transcribe it and figure out what's going on, whether people are awake or whether they're asleep. And then I also discovered that the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Army had created technology that if you knew this, when people slept and how well they slept, we could predict their reaction time and their accident risk. And it was the U.S. military technology that completely fascinated me. It was developed after the first Gulf War. They use it's called mission planning software. So they use that to to plan the B-1 bombing missions. They used it for all of that. And I just found a way through various contacts to get a copy of it and had licensed it and used it and eventually bought the global commercial rights to it.
And what did you buy and what did they do?
So what I bought through my company at the time was the commercial rights, not the military rights, but the commercial rights to the software that can turn sleep data into performance data.
So they were tracking sleep, and then based on that tracking, they would have some sort of inferences that they would make, and then from that, they would make recommendations on performance.
Yes, absolutely. You could tell people's reaction time, and it was highly accurate. In fact, now it's even used by every airline in the U.S. There was a recent program, it was last year. The U.S. Air Force tried to get more money for investment, and they listed the commercial work that I did around that program as one of their top 20 success stories in the last 20 years of taking their technology and commercializing it.
Ah, how cool is that? Okay. Congratulations there.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah. That's a nice investment in the U.S. military. Mm. Yeah. So that being said, can you even more concretely talk about what they were measuring and what they were finding and what that test reaction test is?
Sure. It's a simple PVT, what's called a psychomotor vigilance task. It's a simple reaction time. So okay. It's like a little Game Boy, a light shows up, you have to react to it. And depends how it's designed, anywhere from a 3 to a 10 minute test. And so what they've been able to do, what the military did, was be able to correlate how long you slept and how well you slept with your reaction time. And so what they did was they spent about $20 million and created software that could predict that.
Okay. So my wheels are spinning here, because now you took that, and then how did you commercialize it?
Well, what we did was I realized that the medical grade actigraphs that were being used were terrible. They were not waterproof. Nobody wanted to wear them. They were too big. I bought a bunch of them. I got a drawer full here if you want them. I'd mail them all over the world to companies, and they would get broken in the mail. And so I thought, you know what? There's got to be a better way to build with the same technology a resilient product. And so my analogy is I kind of went from sort of tube technology, from tube TV technology to circuits, right? And I mean, I didn't know how to build it. I mean, I can't build a kite, but I knew that it could be built. And so I just partnered with various companies to build a sleep watch and got it FDA approved, and then married it up with the U.S. military technology that can measure fatigue. So now the product that's on the market not only measures your sleep in real time, but it can also tell you how fatigued and tired you are in real time.
Okay. So you were, and do I have it right? Because I might have had this wrong, that you were one of the first movers, not the first, but one of the first movers in the sport performance arena with, you know, a watch basically that you could wear that would give you information about sleep. And I know that there were some others that were, well, I don't know. Let me just ask naively, like where were you placed in that?
Yeah, I'll be modest and say I was the first person to do it. Okay. Seriously, no one, and this goes back 2007, 2008, absolutely no one was doing that in professional sports.
That's what I thought. I mean, that's when I was first exposed to your work, I was like, this is really disruptive. And it wasn't as good as it is now. Like, you've come a long way as well.
Oh, yeah. It was very manual. We had to take the data off the watch and manually put it into the military technology. And so what happened with that was in 2008, because I'm in Vancouver, the Vancouver Canucks National Hockey League team hired a new president, general manager, a guy named Mike Gillis. And Mike, my office was literally across a bridge you could walk to the arena. And within about a month of him being there, I got a call from one of his staff saying, you know, we understand you work in this space. Can you come and talk to us about it? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can tell you what I'm doing in industry with this, right, to try to prevent work-related, fatigue-related accidents. So I showed up, and in the office was the entire senior management, the entire coaching staff, and all the medical staff. And my introduction from Mike Gillis was, "Hi, this is Pat Byrne. You got 30 minutes." Mm. An hour and a half later, they said, "When can you start?" And that was the beginning for literally for all professional sports of how we started using sleep, monitoring sleep to help players and perform better, and how help teams make better decisions.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Okay. So can we dive into some of the science for just a little bit? Okay.
Sure.
Now, if it's too rich or too deep or not deep enough, because I don't really know what I don't know on sleep, and I know just enough to know how to help people sleep better, but I've got some thoughts underneath I want to try to unpack.
Sure.
Okay. So if we're going to look at sleep, stress, and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, the HPA, if we look at those three functions and structures, what do we need to know about how those interplay with each other? And then the more applied question is, how can we manipulate sleep and or stress to positively impact the HPA?
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't spent a lot of time in HPA. I have to tell you that. Okay. But let me tell you what my view of sleep is, and because okay. I've been very fortunate in the last couple of years, been working with some of the very senior people at Stanford University Medical School around these issues. Sleep is a very complex process.
It really is.
Right. And the sort of traditional wellness model is, you know, nutrition, exercise, and sleep. And I don't believe that.
You don't?
No, because here's how I view sleep. The brain, as you know, is like our CPU. It controls everything we do. Sleep is an important brain function. It's not just something we do. It's an important brain function. The analogy that I use is kind of like when you go to sleep, your car goes into the garage, all these mechanics come out, they clean it up, they gas it up, they change the oil, they get it ready. And when you wake up, you're good to go for the day, right? And so the sleep is such an incredible, important function. And that when you're not getting enough sleep, your car is coming out of the garage with a half a tank of gas, right? And you end up crashing, right? I mean, or you're running out of gas, or you know the oil isn't what it should be. And so, I view sleep that way. But sleep is affected by an incredible number of things. Part of it is, you talk about the DSM. So the mental disorders, right? Sleep disorders, and organic diseases, and the drugs you're taking, recreational, over the counter, prescription drugs, all have an impact on your sleep. One of the downfalls of trying to analyze sleep is it's become very, looking for the right word here. Very unidimensional. And so, you know, if you have a sleep disorder, you go to see a sleep specialist, they don't deal with all of the other issues you're dealing with, right? If you have a mental disorder, you go to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, you deal with that. And so one of the great things about our medical profession in the last decade, or excuse me, last century, is specialization. Right. And it's specializing, whether you're, you know, cardiologist or, you know, pediatrician or whatever you do, is created great benefits to our society. The problem is we're not a bunch of jigsaw puzzles all taped together. We're a holistic person. And as sleep research has evolved, we're not paying attention and we don't have access to deal with all of the various issues. And so, if you want to get your sleep dealt with in an effective way, you need to see a psychiatrist, a psychologist, an internist, a sleep specialist, right? And the list goes on, right? And because and they don't talk to each other in our system, and so that's what excites me about what I'm involved with now more than anything. is the system I'm involved with at Stanford, which deals with all that, because sleep is not just it's so important, and we're not dealing with it in a holistic way.
Okay, so before we get to the venture that you're doing, I want to go back to some functional stuff here.
Sure.
Is that on the sleep side of things, can you maybe guide us on a couple thoughts? Like, these are really practical thoughts, right?
Sure.
Which is what are the three most important ways for people who are running and gunning and hard charging and they're modern day lovers of engagement? What are the three things that we could do to improve sleep?
Okay. Assuming you don't have any health issue, mental health issues, assuming you're a perfectly healthy person.
Do you know anyone like that?
No, but yeah. but assuming you are.
Yeah, okay. Let's assume that you're above the line. Things are pretty good. You maybe got a little garden variety anxiety, depression, something like that. But you're hitting the ground running. Okay.
Right. So you deal with what's called sleep hygiene.
Okay.
And so the certainly the two most critical areas is darkness, and noise.
And how dark and how
okay quiet. Yeah. Okay, here's so literally this time of year, I tape cardboard over my bedroom windows. If you can hold your hand up within a foot of your face and you can still see your hand, it's not dark enough.
Mm. Okay. And that's once the lights go out and you give yourself a moment to acclimate, and then a foot in front and you can see it's not dark enough. Okay. Why is that?
Because we're diurnal animals. Right, so we're biologically programmed to be awake in the daytime and sleep at night. And what triggers melatonin production is darkness. Right, that causes you to go to sleep. So the more light you're exposed to, the less melatonin you have, right? And the harder it is to get to sleep and to stay to sleep.
And that's related to blue lights and digital TVs and phones and apps and all that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No. And so that inhibits melatonin production.
Blue light.
Right? Blue light. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how long does it take, Pat, once you're looking at a screen, how long does it take for your system to clear the effects of the suppressed melatonin?
Yeah, I'm not sure the research is entirely clear in this area, but certainly 30 to 60 minutes.
Okay. So that's a hand grenade fair statement, 30 to 60 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. Keep going. So that's dark. That's definitely dark. And then if you can't get it dark, are you suggesting put something over your eyes, or how important is the darkness?
Darkness is critical.
Okay.
Right. I mean, I've flown all over the world forever and I'm one of these people that can't put things, I'm claustrophobic, so I can't put anything on my face. Mm-hmm. It drives me crazy. So, but there are people that can. So if you can wear eye shades, great.
Right? Okay, cool. Of the tips, is darkness more important, less important than quiet? And are those two more important, less important than the consistency of sleep to wake up time?
It's hard to rank them because there's so much sort of individual variation,
cool.
but certainly darkness is absolutely critical for everyone.
Okay.
Noise, you can put, earplugs in, right? I can't do that again because I don't like the sensation. Noise is very disruptive. And consistency is critical, right? And that's the problem with a lot of professional athletes, obviously, is because they don't have control over their travel schedule and game schedule. But to maintain as much consistency, going to bed at the same time, waking up at the same time, it's really been helpful in terms of getting people to get the sleep they need.
Okay. And then, 8 hours, does research still hold that on average 80% or so of the population benefits from around 8 hours?
Yeah, I think that's right. There's some human variability around everything in life. They basically say 7.5 to 9 hours, depending on your age. A lot of professional athletes that I work with are still teenagers. And the human brain isn't fully developed till they're, 24, 25. And so they're often on this sort of, adolescent circadian rhythm when they're playing professional sports, but the teams don't often recognize that. But yeah, so eight, you know, and a lot of the work that Sherry Ma and others have done around in professional sports basically shown that if you can actually get 8 hours, you can improve your athletic performance.
And she also found, Sherry also found that there's no benefit above 10 hours.
Interesting. The professor I've been working with at Stanford, Maurice Ohayon, who's get his title right, but he's basically the head of sleep epidemiology research at Stanford and public mental health. What he says is if you're consistently sleeping 10 hours or more, that you'll be dead within 5 years.
There's something seriously wrong with the system.
Exactly. And the analogy that I use is saying, look, if your car is going in the garage and instead of getting fixed in 8 hours, it's taking 10 hours to try to get it fixed and it comes out still not fixed, there's something seriously wrong with your vehicle.
We got some leaks. Yeah. Okay. Cool thought. Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something, it's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real-world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep. 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability. And up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO. apolloneuro.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Okay, so then... Can you talk through the difference between sleep quality and sleep length?
And yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and how to increase both to an optimal level, I guess.
Well, humans don't get to choose. Well, you get to choose your sleep length sometimes. Mm-hmm. You have choices around that, but you don't get to choose your sleep quality. So the brain does what it wants to do, right? It's completely independent. And sleep is a involuntary process, not a voluntary process. Okay, I mean, you can push it back, right? You can force yourself to stay awake, but at some point the brain just shuts down and goes to sleep. It gets tired of you trying to keep it awake, right? And so, I mean, if sleep was a voluntary process, we wouldn't have insomnia.
Cool thought. Yeah. Okay.
And so it's an involuntary process. And so when you go to sleep, your brain takes over and it tries to repair itself. It tries to clean itself up. It tries to get you ready, you know, puts out the right hormones and enzymes at the right times to try to repair your body. And as I said, it's like getting your car in the garage with, you know, 20 different mechanics working on your car overnight. Right. And if you don't give them the time to do that, then you're not going to have it properly repaired.
Are those hormones? Is it human growth hormone and testosterone? Are those two of the most important, or are there other ones that are also? I'm sure there are, but I guess the best way to ask that is: what are the main hormones and what are the main enzymes that are at play?
You know what? I'm not a great expert in that area. Okay. I know that there's a lot of research showing that, for example, for repair of particularly back injuries, for example, that the body will put out repair hormones during certain hours of the night, say between 1 and 3 in the morning. And there's a fair bit of research around that. And so if you're depriving yourself of sleeping at night, you're depriving yourself of repair mechanisms for your whole body. And again, I said, you know, that sleep is such a new science that literally I spent half my day reading research every day.
I know. Yeah, I don't know how you keep up with it. I mean, that, I guess that is your field and your passion. And it's just phenomenal what's coming out. It's really good. And can you scare me for a minute? Can you scare me, like, literally into why I need to be sleeping optimally? Like, I'd love to hear the most dramatic statements you could make so I could pass them on to others about, like, why sleep is important. I've heard things like, if you don't get good sleep for X, what is it, 5 days? Wait, 1 week at 5 hours? It's like driving a car drunk or something like that. Like, can you give me that kind of stuff?
Oh, sure. I mean,
I can scare
you. Oh, it's easy. I'll scare you easy, Michael. Yeah, no, look, sleep is a central function to what we do, right? And it's not surprising that when you're not getting the sleep that you need, that every system in your body is affected, right? It increases diabetes risk. It increases obesity risk. It increases accident risk. You know, every year in the U.S., there are over 100,000 serious car crashes because people falling asleep behind the wheel. And so if you take an average of 8 hours of sleep and you're only getting 6, that means within a week you're cognitively as brilliant as somebody that's been awake for 24 hours. Mm, okay. Right? Let me give you one more example. Even if you're a good sleeper and you stay awake for long periods of time, for example, if you're awake for 24 straight hours, even if you're normally a good sleeper, that you have the equivalent reaction time of somebody that's 0.1 alcohol.
And that's if you're deficit how much sleep?
You stay awake for 24 hours.
Okay, so at 24 hours, if you're up a full 24 hours, your reaction time is over the legal limit for driving.
Absolutely. In fact, in New Jersey, and it's a warning to your listeners here, Michael, if you're in New Jersey and you're awake for 24 hours, it is a criminal offense to be awake 24 hours and drive in New Jersey. Hmm. It's punishable up to 10 years in prison. Same as drinking and driving.
Wow. Okay. So it doesn't matter. Like your reaction time is so bad that it's dangerous.
Right. And that is precisely why we have drinking and driving laws, is not because they don't like alcohol. It's because it affects your reaction time and your decision making. And not sleeping well and not sleeping long enough has the same reaction.
Okay, so, all right, keep going. I know it's bad, but like, give me some immunity stuff or give me some other stuff.
Immunity. So, yeah. And so these are all choices, whether you're an athlete or not, they're choices you have to make in life.
And then how do I rule out a sleep disorder? And my rule of thumb has been like, after 3 weeks of trying your ass off with great sleep hygiene, you know, getting the dark right, the noise right, the consistency right, having some sort of hygiene where you're gradually putting yourself to sleep or dimming your stimulation throughout the day, that if you've done those for 3 weeks and you're still screwed up on sleep, then you probably have a sleep disorder. Am I out of bounds on that?
You're close.
Okay.
Not totally out of bounds, but your ball's kind of on it.
Okay. Yeah. Sharpen me
almost
up.
Almost out of bounds.
Sharpen me up. I want to get right on that.
Sure. Yeah. No. So this is what excites me about the systems I'm working with at Stanford right now is the diagnosis of sleep disorders, mental disorders, organic diseases, the drugs you're taking, recreational, over the counter, whatever you're taking, has an effect on your sleep. And so the system that I'm working with is a program, an artificial intelligence computer program that's been around for over 10 years, but used in other spaces, that can diagnose sleep disorders, mental disorders, organic diseases within an hour, either over the internet or on the phone, in every language in the world.
Yeah. When you shared this technology, this is phenomenal, Pat.
It's stunning. It is shocking. In fact, I call it the Uber of the medical profession. Mm-hmm. It scares the hell out of.
That was when you first shared it. That was my response too. I was like, whoa.
Yeah, it's highly validated. I'm super excited about this. This is the program that the U.S. military is now starting to look at. I mean, if you think you have a sleep problem and you want to go to a sleep specialist, it's going to cost you or your insurance company a couple of $1,000s for an overnight sleep study. Mm-hmm. You can get the same level of validation and the same diagnosis on your smartphone for $50.
Phenomenal. And what percentage of globally? Let's go globally if you can. What percentage have sleep disorders or problems sleeping, would you say?
On the biological side, the sleep disorder side, I mean, there's kind of mixed results, but it's anywhere from sort of 25 to, you know, 35, 40% of the global population have some form of biological sleep disorder.
Sleep disorder, and are you lumping that in with disordered sleeping?
No,
you're just saying sleep disorder.
Yeah. And so this is how I kind of define it for athletes, mm-hmm. is that there are biological issues that prevent you from sleeping, which I includes mental disorders, sleep disorders, and organic diseases, okay. and the medications they're taking. And then there's the choices that they make in their life, which is where you live and how, you know, when you party or whether you stay up late or whether you have kids at home. I mean, for the most part, the choices that you make. And then there's the choices that either your employer makes. And so whether you're an athlete, it's the choices that the league makes and the team makes about when you meet and when you travel and when you play games, right? And so those are the three kind of buckets that I would put people in. And when we design fatigue management programs, we make sure that you deal with all three of those. Because if you can only deal with one, you're wasting your time. Mm.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so get back to me, like at the ball in the court here on 3 weeks. How do you sharpen that thought up? If you really take a run at sleep hygiene and you're still kind of a mess on sleep, How long should I wait? How long should I try an organic, homeopathic, whatever approach to getting my sleep rhythms right?
I mean, I think you have to do a little bit of internal searching, but you know, if after a week you can't get into a proper rhythm, then you got an issue.
Okay. Right. All right. So if we met in the middle and said after 2 weeks you would feel better.
I mean, it's up to you, and it depends what you do. I mean, it depends how critical your work is and how critical sleep is to what you're doing. Right?
That's a cool thought. Well, all of us want to be vibrant in life.
Well, yeah. Not everybody in life. Not everybody I've met, but yeah, a lot of people, yeah, particularly in the athletic side.
Okay. All right. So, okay. How about this idea? Is that after X number of days of proper sleep, so if a person that's relatively fatigued, they're on average 5.5-6 hours of sleep, which is like most of the running and gunners outside of sport that I know. Athletes tend to do pretty good on sleep, actually, for the most part, in my experience. You're seeing that differently? Okay, put a pin in that because I want to talk about that. And then, so let's say outside of sport, corporate, entrepreneurs and family structure, people that are running families, is that 5.5-6.5, somewhere in that range, and they're tired. They've got a low level hum. They forget what it feels like to be vibrant. And then how many days of proper sleep or nights of proper sleep do they need to forget fatigue?
Greg, I love that question. So there's a couple ways to approach that. First of all, if you're actually talking about full recovery, that's what I love about the US military technology. It actually can predict how long it takes you to recover depending on how long you haven't slept for. And so, for example, if you've been up for 24 straight hours, most people, it's 5 or 6 nights of 8 hours of sleep to recover.
Okay.
But here's the great thing about the brain. It fools you. And so there's some great studies done by Hans van Doneghan and others. Hans now at Washington State University, but Walter Reed. And so what they've discovered is that when you routinely do not get the 8 hours of sleep you need, that your brain, which what I call renorms, and basically your brain tells you, you know, this is your new normal, so get used to it.
Because that's a substandard norm.
Right, and that's typically, and that's exactly what happens when they actually put people through sleep deprivation or sleep restriction studies, and they measure their actual reaction time in a black box, so they don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then they ask them to self-report their fatigue. That after a couple of days of poor sleep, they kind of go, you know what, I don't feel that badly anymore. Right? And so I call that renorming. It's going, okay, this is now my new normal. And so that's what's happened in our society, is people are, they're walking around in their new normal feeling perfectly fine. I think they're feeling perfectly fine, but on objective testing, they don't do very well.
Okay. Why would our brain do that?
I don't know. I've been talking to my brain about that for a long time and it won't answer me. I think it's just a defense mechanism. I think that's my sense of it. But it is what it is. And that's part of, I think, the whole discovery around sleep and fatigue issues that we're going through right now. Everything we know about sleep and fatigue, particularly around sports or even in industry, we've known in the last decade.
Okay, that's great. Now, let's go back to sport. And the challenges I see with athletes in sleeping is that it's hard to shut it down. And so they're up in weird rhythms. And after a game, they're so stimulated, it's hard for them to get it right, to turn it off. And maybe I'm biased because I value sleep in whatever context I'm going in. So I try to help work with the system to get sleep right. And for instance, trying not to schedule meetings within 10 hours of the last time we saw each other. There's like an environmental rule that we try to put in place. And that I've seen that work wonders. Now, you're saying that the athlete population struggles with sleep more than the general population.
I'm not sure more, but turns out most of the athletes I've ever met are human beings. And they struggle with this, a lot of the same issues that other humans do, right? They have some, depends on the sport, but they have some unique issues in terms of, you know, quick travel, circadian rhythm disruptions. I've put athletes into three buckets: the decisions the athletes make, decisions that the team make, and biological, what's going on biologically with the players.
Cool.
Right. And so I've seen athletes cope very well with that, because, you know, they don't have biological issues. The team is very good about how they schedule things. I like your 10-hour rule. I think that's important. I've seen teams that don't get that, right? And there's still a lot of ignorance in professional sports around scheduling. They just think sleep is something the players can just get over, and they can't. And I see a lot of, and I've seen athletes who have struggled, you know, with lifestyle issues, you know, particularly in Major League Baseball and some of the other teams I work with. These guys are, you know, this, they got so much downtime, right? They're you know, abusing themselves. I mean, there's some studies done that there was a, I think it was a 5-year study. They looked at 80 random Major League Baseball players. And they asked them to self-report their sleep in terms of their quality, sort of good sleep, medium sleep, poor sleep. And at the end of 5 years, they went back and recontacted the players. And of the players that self-reported poor sleep, only 14% were still playing in the league.
Wow, that's a great stat.
Right. And it was, you know, it was linear, so that, you know, the players that reported themselves as good sleepers, 73% were still playing in the league.
Come on. And this is at the major league level?
Major League Baseball level. Absolutely. And in fact, I've worked in every league in North America and Australia, and I can tell you without naming names that for every team I've worked with, the best sleepers on the team are their best players. Without a doubt. Easy.
Okay. What would you think about this strategy? Is if an athlete was hurt and they need to, there's medical benefits. Let me just say it this way, that a physician recommends or a therapist recommends that they do some sort of treatment on the acute injury every 3 hours, every 2 hours to increase the speed of recovery for that joint. And that means that they're going to disrupt their sleep. What would you think about that strategy?
I think it's stupid. I mean, to be blunt, mm-hmm. I mean, it's based on complete ignorance as far as I'm concerned. And what it says to me is they don't understand the value and the necessity of sleep, and that physical recovery, sleep is an important part of physical recovery as well as mental recovery.
And then when you say mental recovery, are you thinking cognitive, focus and like, okay.
Reaction time and ability to concentrate.
And then what about mentally, which is a bit, is the software, which is the ability to regulate arousal and those sorts of things. What do you think about that part of sleep deprivation or restriction?
My view is that sleep is such an important function for everything we do, that it's not surprising if you start disrupting sleep, you're disrupting all the biological and mental processes within our bodies.
Okay. So I looked at some of the research that just came out on the splitting of the 8 hours into 2 4-hour camps, and I don't like it. And I'm wondering where you are on that research.
I'm with you. Part of the challenge around reading a lot of sleep research is it's poorly done, quite frankly. They don't measure sleep properly. They don't measure performance properly. They don't take into account mental disorders or organic diseases or drugs that they're taking. A lot of the sleep research around professional sports in around what you're talking about, the splitting of things, is just poorly designed research. And I don't mean to criticize the researchers, but a lot of this is new. They're trying to get, you know, they're trying to get their feet on this and try to figure things out. And they're not doing a very good job, quite frankly.
Is there an assessment that we can take online or some sort of self-assessment that you could give us to measure if we're possibly sleep restricted or fatigued in some kind of way?
There are a couple of questionnaires, but basically the questionnaires ask you whether you're sleeping or you're not. You already know the answers to some of those. There's actually a really great one out of Munich that helps you to figure out what, you know, whether you're a morning person or an evening person. And it's actually pretty accurate, and it actually gives you some sleep tips around how to manage your sleep around all of that.
Is there a specific link I could go check out?
Yeah. I can send you that link. I don't have it in front of me, but I'll send you that link.
Okay, great.
But the problem is we tend to think of sleep as one thing, and sleep is multifactorial.
Mm.
All right. And there's so many things that influence our sleep. We tend to focus on one thing, whether it's your environment, whether it's, you know, how the teams organize the travel or, you know, the games, but it has everything to do with our a holistic human beings. And so I think researchers are finally starting to get around to understanding how complicated sleep research is.
Yeah. And one in particular is back to that hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, that HPA mm-hmm. stuff, is that there's negative impacts on thinking and analyzing and attention and even working memory. And those three or four structure or systems I just talked about are really horsepower for performance, to be able to think clearly, to focus deeply, and to remember the frames that you've seen in the past to adjust to the new. And so I'm agreeing with you that those that sleep well tend to maximize their performance potential better than those that don't. And it's one of the silent thieves of potential for sure.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and I've had this discussion with some Major League Baseball teams as well, which is, you know what, you're losing. They have these massive numbers of players in their system, and they could be losing some very good players because they're not talking to them about sleep, they're not dealing with whatever sleep issues they may have. You know, the philosophy in Major League sports, and certainly in North America, is you're on your own. You know, if you want to perform and get to our level, we'll look after you a little bit. But I think they're losing a lot of players in the system because no one's helping them.
Okay. All right. And then when we think about professional sports, imagine that I was connected to a team, a professional team on the West Coast, and we had to travel to the East Coast. And we've tried many different ways to optimize our fatigue by the time so that we're more ready when we play the game. Would you suggest that we try to get on their biological clock, or would you say stay on our biological clock?
Great question. And it's one of these things, it depends. Let me give you a couple of examples. In the National Football League, there's a great 40-year study that shows that West Coast teams who go to the East Coast for evening games have a statistically greater win record than the East Coast teams. But when they go from the West Coast to the East Coast for afternoon games, there's no statistical difference. And the way it's been analyzed is to say, look, if you've got an 8 o'clock game, for example, in Tampa Bay or whatever, and you come from the West Coast, and so the time difference is 3 hours. And so for an 8 o'clock East Coast game, your circadian rhythm is at 5 o'clock, which means your reaction time is actually, your natural reaction time is increasing till 8 o'clock, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and then it starts to drop off. Where the East Coast team, they start at 8 o'clock and their reaction time is dropping off. And if you do the calculations to the military technology, there's actually a 9 to 10% difference in reaction time between the two teams. And over time, that shows up as an advantage to West Coast teams. So that's an example of a situation where you wouldn't want to get to the East Coast too fast if you're a West Coast team.
Yeah, okay. Right? And then what about with a 1 o'clock game on the East Coast, which would, if we back that out 3 hours for the West Coast, you know, we're talking
right,
about.
Right. And certainly National Football League, what they showed in that study was that it didn't make any difference in terms of win-loss records. Because the difference in reaction time between 1 and 4 isn't as significant as it is between 5 and 8.
You know, I'm not going to question the data. It sounds like it's if you're citing it, it's thoughtful, or respect. I'll respect that. My experience has been it's a 10 a.m. biological clock for that team, and you've got to get to the to the arena 3 hours ahead of time. So now right. We're arriving at 7 a.m.
Oh, yeah. So sleep loss and circadian are different.
Okay, but it's not – let me think about this. Okay, good thought. Because it's not that we've lost sleep, but our biological clock is arriving at the stadium at 7 a.m., which means our biological clock, we woke up at like 4:30
a.m. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so that – and so, you know, your reaction time at any point in time is a function of your circadian rhythm and your sleep history. So it's a combination of both.
And then when are our reaction times highest based on circadian rhythm? Is it a 10 o'clock and a 1 o'clock?
No, 7:30 at night.
7:30 at night is the highest. That's when we're the most vigilant.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So what happens at 10 and 1? Why did I get confused there?
No, it's lower. I mean, it at 10 o'clock in the morning, it's not as high as it is at 1, right? You wake up, it's lower, and then it starts to come up. But the difference between 10 and 1 isn't as significant as it is between 7:30 and or 8 o'clock and 5 o'clock.
Ah, okay. So there's like a – what's it called? A leptokurtic curve, where like a hockey stick arc?
I can show you some graphs, but that, so that's basically it. But it also, I mean, if you're dealing with like the NBA and the NHL I've dealt with, where they play back-to-back games and they play 4 games in 6 nights and travel across different time zones, then that starts to get really insane.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, last thing about sleep kind of hygiene and stuff. What are your thoughts on napping?
Napping is great. Napping is sleep. Virtually all of the players I've dealt with in National Hockey League and the NBA all nap in the afternoon. The challenge with napping is it's much like caffeine, right? You don't want to take it too close to when you normally go to bed because then you can't get to sleep. Right.
Does your body start to crave a nap if you nap at the same time every day?
Yeah, I think so. And the reason you nap is because you're not getting enough sleep during the night.
Ah, got it. Okay. And so does the duration of nap, like if when you slip into REM sleep, does that impact the quality of sleeping later?
Yes and no. I mean, there's a lot of theories around napping. And part of it is, of course, we sleep in cycles, although it's not as clean as a lot of the recent, you know, people say it is, in terms of the cycles where you go into a deeper sleep and then back out again and then into REM sleep and then back into a deeper sleep. And so what happens if you wake up in a deep sleep, you're pretty groggy. It's called sleep inertia, right? And it takes most people about half an hour to get over that. And so, you know, if you're an athlete and you're sleeping, you know, for an hour in the afternoon, you wake up in a deep sleep, who cares if you're not playing until that night? Right, you'll get over it.
Okay, got it. All right. So then, okay, last thing I would love to celebrate is your new business venture. Like, is it still a bit away, or is this something people should be paying attention to now? And when can I start playing with it a little bit with you? Like, where are we in that cycle?
Right. So here's where we're at. So, you know, part of my whole journey around the sleep and fatigue is to find technology that's been used in different spaces. So Dr. Maurice Ohayon created this technology more than a decade ago, and it's been used successfully in epidemiological research. He's one of the most respected sleep and fatigue and psychiatrists in the world. He's a medical doctor, he's a neurologist and a psychiatrist, but also has PhDs in biology, mathematics, and computer science. Okay. He is the director of the Stanford Sleep Epidemiology Research Center and the chief of the Division of Public Mental Health and Population Sciences. Brilliant at Stanford. Brilliant man.
Yeah,
brilliant. Brilliant man. And so we connected a couple of years ago because I became very concerned that there was this gap in the technology around sleep for athletes. Because we could, you know, with sleep watches, we can kind of tell when you're asleep and when you're awake, but we can't tell anything else about your health. So I connected with him and basically convinced him to turn what's basically an epidemiological tool into a clinical tool. And so he's actually put it online. And so it's available right now. B2B business right now, because we don't have the capacity to help millions of people. The most we can do is probably 100,000 a week, right? And so we're in the stages right now of dealing with the U.S. military and some of the veterans associations and trying to bring that to their group. But certainly by the end of or mid to end of 2017, it'll be open generally. It's available now for a team thing. So if you got a professional sports team and you want to get through the system, we can do that as a team. And we just don't have the staff to deal with 100,000 individual people. We can deal with a small number of clients that can manage their people and organize all of the infrastructure that's needed for this. But the technology is mature, it's highly validated, and it's ready to go. It's the most brilliant thing that I've ever seen in the whole field of sleep research.
Okay. And what's the name of it?
It's called Sleep Eval. So Sleep Evaluation, but Sleep-Eval. Okay. They have a website, but the website's a research website. But if you want to like figure, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of research papers that have used this technology. In fact, many of the manuals that you talked about, the DSM and others, were actually the diagnosis that are listed in the manuals were as a result of the research used with this research tool, the Sleep Eval tool.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so can I ask you some questions about you now?
Sure.
Okay, optimistic or pessimistic?
Depends what I'm thinking about, but mostly optimistic. Okay. Yeah.
Street smart or analytical?
Oh God, both.
If you had to pick one, which one are you better at?
Analytical, I think.
Do you prefer to be in a fast-paced or slow-paced environment?
Oh boy. Slow-paced, I would think.
If you could be the first person to go to Mars with a 50% chance of coming back, would you go?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What is your need for control or to be in control?
Pretty low.
Mm-hmm. Are you more intellectually competitive or physically competitive?
Intellectually.
And then how high on a scale of 1 to 10 would you be on intellectual competitiveness?
Probably 8.
Internally driven or externally driven? And same thing, put scales to those two.
And I'm way more internally driven. I drive myself way more than and I'm motivated way more by myself than I am with others.
And then what number would you put on that 1 to 10 scale?
8.
8. And then why be driven? Like, what is that about for you?
I think it's an internal success drive. I want to succeed. I want to help people. I want to create new things. I want to do new things.
What are you most hungry for? Like, what are you really straining and striving? You've made money. You've made success. You've built a beautiful place for people to be more aware of themselves through technology. Like, what are you really hunting or searching for?
I don't think that's enough for me. I want to help people on a much broader scale. Like, I think on this new system and technology I'm dealing with, I think we have an opportunity to really upset the entire medical profession in North America and to really make it way more cost effective and give people the opportunity to take control of their own health.
Okay. Are you more critical or positive of yourself?
Critical.
And do you make fast decisions or slow decisions?
Oh boy. it depends on the context. I do both.
Okay. A high trust of others or low trust?
I tend to trust people.
More introverted or extroverted?
You know, I'm on the fence. I can be both. I tend to be when I'm in small groups, I'm more introverted. When I'm in bigger groups, I'm more extroverted.
Okay. pressure comes from?
Pressure comes from myself, from wanting to succeed and wanting to create new things. I mean, we're only on this planet once, right? And you kind of, for me, I want to leave a positive impact. And I don't mean that in a kind of a frivolous way. I really feel as I get older, the more I'm driven to for success.
Okay. And then let's round this right out here. How do you articulate or think about or define mastery?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard for me because it just happens for me. I mean, mastery for me is really a learning process, and I crave to learn. I crave to learn, particularly from smart people, crave to learn new things. And for mastery, it means for me to be able to learn from some of the smartest people on the planet and to be able to meld together their thoughts and to be able to meld together technologies and to create new solutions to old problems.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's okay. And then what do you hope the next generation gets right?
I hope they get right that they actually care about themselves and not get caught up in social trends so much, that to become independent thinkers and be critical of scientific research and quasi-scientific research. And I hope they have the opportunity to learn real basic science and to be able to make critical decisions about what they want to do with their life, but also about, as a society, what kind of decisions do we make and how do we make lives better for everyone? I mean, I see today, so many, it's not like they're sheep. They just don't have the education and experience to be critical of some of this, the scientific research that's going on. I mean, a great example is, I don't want to sort of beat up people, but looking at things like Fitbit. And how many people wear that and run around and look at the data when in fact they're largely random number generators, right? They have there's no scientific validation whatsoever on that technology. They're being sued in federal court in California. But people accept it. They accept it at face value because they don't have the experience and the education to ask hard questions.
That's troubling.
It is, but I'm a big fan of education and a big fan of giving people experiences and when you get older, you have that sometimes, it is troubling. And I think, we're in a kind of society where, people chase the latest bauble, right? It's all about bling.
Yeah, it is. And then, what is your favorite technology for sleep monitoring or sleep awareness? What do you recommend for people to get better at sleep?
You have to be a little bit careful about this because I think if you want to look at a sleep watch, I would use anything that's FDA approved. Right?
Cool.
But also you need to understand how complex sleep is and all of the various factors that go into it. That's why I said I'm a huge fan of this whole Sleep Eval program, which gives you the opportunity to look at holistically what's causing your sleep issues, right? And then you can make decisions about what you want to do with it.
Pat, I love it. I mean, you're thoughtful, clear thinking, understand the space from a lot of different angles. And then last simple little question is, how do we get a hold, or how do people follow what you're doing, or what's the best way for them to be aware of your businesses and research and thoughts?
Probably on my LinkedIn account, mm-hmm. A little bit on Twitter. I'm in the final stages of editing a book on sleep and performance for athletes that I've co-written with my daughter.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
And so we're going to put up a website in the next couple of months and market it as well. But we cover off a lot of the topics that you've talked about it. And she's a big sleep person as well. She just actually is graduating in May from Tulane University Law School in sports law.
Well done. Okay, so what is your Twitter handle?
It is @sleepsports.
Okay, yeah. Brilliant. All right, so listen, thank you for your time. Thank you for spending your valuable resource here with us. And then, you know, seriously, Pat, I love what you're doing and I love how you do it. And so I'm wishing you the best success.
Appreciate that, Michael. It's great connecting with you again.
Yeah, for sure. And for everybody listening, thank you for being part of this. Head over to iTunes if you haven't subscribed and look up Finding Mastery. We're also going to have Pat's brilliant insights embedded into a second podcast called Minutes on Mastery. And if you can share a comment or review, we love the support. It helps gain the momentum we're looking for. Thank you for checking in with our sponsors. You can find me @MichaelGervais on Twitter. And you can find us on Instagram @FindingMastery. Okay, all the best. Pat, appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Okay, thanks. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.